Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Emma Norris. So the votes have been cast and at the time of recording, lots of them have been counted. So this episode of Inside Briefing is going to travel from London to Liverpool, to the West Midlands and to the Tees Valley, Manchester to Yorkshire and across the many council elections in England and Wales. Oh, and a by-election in Blackpool South as well. We're going to be reacting to a big night in British politics and explore what it tells us about mayors, about the way people think about their local politicians, and look at how the electoral map has shifted. We're also going to ask what it all means for Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. After all the expectation management, who can claim victory and who should be worried? And does any of this tell us anything about the general election and how it might turn out, or what it means for Sunak's job security? And then we'll take a leap forward to what we think is an absolutely urgent task for whoever wins the next general election, and that's setting budgets for government departments. Because right now, those budgets are set to expire in April. We're approaching a cliff edge moment. In fact, we're very nearly into uncharted territory. A new IFG paper sets out what the next government urgently needs to do, and we'll be speaking to its author. Joining me throughout is Akash Pound, who leads all our work on devolution. Hi, Akash.
Hi, Emma.
Did you stay up for the results or did you just get up early to find out what happened overnight?
I did not stay up. No, there wasn't that much being declared overnight, of course. So I wasn't going to lose all my sleep just for Blackpool South and a couple of councils. But yeah, lots of interesting results coming in now for sure.
Yeah, very sensible. And I'm delighted that we're joined by political journalist Rachel Wearmouth. Hi, Rachel. How are you? Did you stay up watching the elections all night?
Yes, I was saddo and I did stay up for the Blackpool South by-election and from many of the councils, yeah, and I'm powered by Red Bull today.
Yeah, I kept my phone under my pillow, so in a similar boat. So we're recording this podcast at 2:30 on Friday. We've already had quite a few results in. We'll probably get some during the recording as well. Labour have enjoyed a massive win in the Blackpool South by-election. We'll talk about that a bit later in the podcast, but let's begin by focusing on the local results. Akash, can you give us a quick rundown? What results have we got so far and what are some of the biggest that we've heard?
Yeah, so at the time of recording, as you say, I mean, there's more results being declared all the time. But we've had three official declarations from the big Metro Mayor contest. So there's 10 big Metro Mayorities up for grabs this year. And the big results so far are that Ben Houchin in Tees Valley has been re-elected for a third term. So bit of good news there for the Conservatives. I thought I'd start with that because aside from that, there isn't much, to be honest. And then we've also just heard recently that Kim McGuinness, the Labour candidate for the new North East mayoralty, has been successfully elected there. Not a big surprise, though she was facing a challenge from the independent Jamie Driscoll. Conservatives were nowhere really. And then more of a surprise, the Labour candidate has won in North Yorkshire as well, where the Conservatives had been expecting potentially to win. And, you know, in a normal or even sort of half bad year for them, they might well have won in that part of the country. But given the overall state of the polls, the Conservative candidate has lost, and David Scaife of Labour Party has won there. We're expecting Labour also to win shortly in the East Midlands, which again is one the Conservatives would have hoped to pick up. So those are the mayoralties, and the other six we're going to be waiting till tomorrow for. On the local election front, I mean, the Conservatives are losing still more than 50% of every seat that they're defending. I mean, based on the numbers in front of me at the moment, which keep changing, they've won 184 at this moment and they've lost 219. So they're really kind of hemorrhaging councillors all over the country. Labour have made quite a lot of gains, but so too have Lib Dems and lots of independents elected as well. Labour have gained control of, I think, six councils net at the time of speaking. And those are spread also across different parts of the country, which they'll be pleased about. You know, Thurrock in Essex, places in Hartlepool in the northeast, Hindburn in Lancashire, places in Hampshire and the Midlands as well. So quite a good spread, I suspect, from their perspective that they'll be very pleased with.
Brilliant. Thanks, Akash. Rachel, what do you make of the results so far? We know that Sunak is going to be breathing a sigh of relief that Hutchin did retain the mayoralty in Tees Valley. But does that actually tell us anything about the national picture? I mean, he chose not to wear a Conservative rosette, not to mention the words Sunak in his victory speech. Was it more about his personal brand?
Yes and no. I would say about Tees Valley generally is that it's worth looking at some of the mayoral contests that it's had there since, you know, the late 90s. So, I mean, Hartlepool has picked an independent, a directly elected mayor, similarly with Ray Mallon, who was once upon a time the independent mayor of Middlesbrough. So it has a tradition and an independent spirit. And I think Ben Houchin can tap into that very, very well. But on the other hand, Rishi Sunak has very personally invested in Tees Valley. You know, when you think about developments like Treasury North, which I'm sure he may pop up at in the next day or two. So I think it does certainly help his position. And when you look at Ben Houchin's reaction, I think you could describe it as kind of indifferent about Rishi Sunak. He kind of said, well, I don't really care who the Prime Minister is. So it's not really a ringing endorsement. So it's kind of like he's been perhaps put on notice by some Conservatives. But I think it was once upon a time expected that that was going to be, you know, the blow that would knock him out, or that Ben Houchin's words after the result would be a very, very big deal. But that's kind of taken the wind out of it somewhat. But when you look at some of the other seats in the local elections more generally, Labour is picking up votes in all of the areas that particularly former Brexit voting areas, ones that they lost in 2019, it's picking up votes there in, you know, parcelfuls and is winning. So I'm not sure the Prime Minister can take much comfort from the results overall.
Yeah, and we had an event with John Curtis earlier in the week, and he was saying that actually the really high-profile Metro Mayor contests aren't a very good indicator of national vote share, and that actually some of the kind of quieter, much less high-profile local elections are a better tell for how accurate the national polling is. Are there any particularly striking local results on that front, do you think?
I thought Thurrock was one such vote. Redditch is always, you know, a bellwether seat that would tell you, you know, where some of those seats generally tend to show you the direction of the general election. Milton Keynes stood out as well. But obviously, Labour will be very disappointed that it didn't take Harlow, which, you know, Keir Starmer spent a lot of time there and said, kind of put a pin in Harlow and said, Harlow will be the judge of our success, essentially. And they missed out there by just one seat. So I think there's probably some lessons for the Labour Party as well. And beyond that, I'd kind of draw attention to the level of sort of backlash to Labour's position on Gaza has really been noticeable in these results. And I suspect sometimes that's expressed through support for the Green Party. Although South Tyneside has had a successful Green campaign there for some time, the jump in the Green vote there was quite instructive. So there was a lot of echoes of 2004 generally, actually, because when you looked at Newcastle City Council, that had Lib Dem support going up. And when you look at places like Blackburn as well, you know, a lot of these areas have, you know, are some of like left liberal voters, perhaps, or they have bigger Muslim populations than other areas, which would show you that there's a lot of frustration with Keir Starmer's Gaza position, I think.
Yeah,
well, that's the issue that seems to have cost them control of Oldham Council. That's the one Labour's actually lost, and it seems that it was definitely the Gaza issue and independent candidates standing specifically on that issue, to the extent that you can do that in a local council election, seem to be the ones who've taken Labour council seats away, and that's gone to no overall control as a result.
And Akash, what do we know about turnout so far? How has turnout looked at the locals?
I haven't seen projections for the local elections overall. I mean, for the mayoralties, we've got the figures from the four that are declaring today, on the Friday, that is. And they're all round about 30%, so 28% in the East Midlands, 30 or 31% in the other three. That's Tees Valley, North Yorkshire and North East. So, I mean, in the case of Tees Valley, which is the only one where this is not the first election, that's down, actually, 3% down from last time that was elected in 2021. So overall, yes, not spectacularly high turnout, kind of similar to what you'd expect for council elections. Meanwhile, though, I mean, PCC elections are being held as well, of course. No, a few results of that from that those coming through so far. But in terms of turnout, you can see the kind of lower level of interest in those from, for example, in Wales, where only PCC elections are taking place. So there's no other reason for people to go to the polls unless they're keen to engage on the PCC election. And turnout for those has been between 16 and 20%, which I think says something specific about PCCs as a not very successful model of democratic engagement.
I don't know if we've mentioned this just before we came to record. Labour was calling York and North Yorkshire as theirs, which is quite significant because it covers Rishi Sunak's constituency in North Yorkshire, which is, you know, quite a big deal, actually. Yeah, not a Labour voting area at all.
I think that one's been officially declared now. David Scaife won, 35% to 27% for Keane Duncan, the Conservative candidate. So, yeah. That's quite a surprising result.
And then there were a couple of changes yesterday to the way that we do voting. Akash, I'm going to ask you about changes to the voting system itself in a minute. But Rachel, it was also the first time that there's been a requirement for voter ID. What kind of impact do we know that that's had, if any?
I'm not sure that's altogether clear just yet, but we do know, and there was the sort of funny story that made all the overnight papers, was that the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, the politician who introduced voter identification, apparently forgot to bring his ID. So I think that the sort of impact so far is unclear as far as I'm aware. I don't know if any groups who've been monitoring specifically have come out and made statements. I haven't seen them myself, but There were certainly very, very many fears before voters went to the polls that, you know, it would potentially hurt Labour's vote more than it would the Conservative Party's vote. But I haven't seen any specific reaction as to impact just yet.
Thanks, Rachel. And yeah, Akash, the other change was the voting system itself in some cases. Tell us a bit about that on what impact it might have had.
Yeah, sure. So up until now, all elections for Metro mayors, police and crime commissioners, and also local authority mayors, there's one of those being elected this time in Salford, have been held using the supplementary vote system where voters can cast a first and second preference. And then if no one wins over 50% in the first round, second preferences of lower ranked candidates get distributed to the top two, and you, that was how we elected all our mayors and so on until recently. It's now being done under first past the post. The Conservatives made that change a couple of years ago in legislation that also brought in voter ID. So what difference is that likely to make? Well, I mean, we'll do a bit of analysis of that once we have all the results in, to the extent that you can kind of predict what would have happened under a different voting system. I mean, what we can say is that, I mean, under the 223 elections that were held using supplementary vote since 2000, before the system was abolished, On 17 occasions, the candidate who came first in first preferences was then not elected because they were overtaken by the second place candidate. So that means, you know, from not that rarely, the electoral system change might lead to a different winner in the end. And just as an example from one of the early results we have had, the Cambridgeshire Police and Crime Commissioner election was won fairly narrowly by the Conservative candidate, who won 38% of the vote, just ahead of Labour's candidate with 36%. And then there were 25% or 26% of the votes for the Liberal Democrat candidate. So I think if there was SV in that case, almost certainly the Labour candidate, or quite likely the Labour candidate, would have won because she would have picked up more of the Lib Dem second preferences. And that, interestingly, is the area where the previous Conservative mayor of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough was defeated in 2021 for exactly that reason, because the Labour candidate finished second and then picked up lots of second preferences from Lib Dems and Greens. So, yeah, the change does seem to have saved at least one Conservative this year.
Really interesting. And we'll find out more about that as the results continue to come in over the next few days. Now, talking of results coming in, there are obviously lots more tomorrow. Rachel, I don't want to ask you to predict anything that could be out of date, but is it possible that Sadiq Khan could be in trouble in London?
I've thought this for some time. I think we know from the Uxbridge by-election that ULEZ was a huge issue for voters, and they were prepared to go to the ballot box and express as much. And I wonder if he has some problem in outer London. I think the change to the voting system obviously doesn't help him. There was a bit of what appeared to be, it was either the Labour Party trying to squeeze Susan Hall's vote, the Conservative candidate's vote, or it was genuinely having a little wobble yesterday when Sadiq Khan put out a tweet which said, or a post on X, I forget what we need to call them these days, but put a post out on social media saying that encouraging Greens and Lib Dems to make sure that they would lend him their vote if they cared about progressive causes, basically. And I do just pick up a little bit of nervousness, but well, I guess we don't have to wait long to find out, but it would be the shock of the entire local election results if it did happen.
One of the biggest
misjudgments or one of the biggest polling errors in what history, I guess.
I saw some chatter just before we started recording this that it looked like at least during verifications in Camden that Hall had done a lot better there than you might expect, at least in some parts. So, as you say, let's wait and see for tomorrow, but that would be an enormous upset if so. Okay, so let's turn our attention to what all this means for the national picture for Sunak and Keir Starmer. And let's start with the by-election, which you haven't talked much about yet. Rachel, Blackpool South is a big win for Keir Starmer, historic swing. And what should we read into it?
I mean, the Labour Party would certainly like you to look at it and have the headlines from this vote in particular, as evidenced by Pat McFadden, their national campaign coordinator, saying, you know, this is the only vote that matters. You know, they want to show off about just how well they've done there. So they've put an awful lot of effort into it, clearly. It is one of those Brexit voting areas, those coastal areas that they've kind of struggled to win back in the past. So when it comes to, you know, Deborah Mattinson's hero voters strategy, that seems to be working quite well for the Labour Party here. And it's a pretty big win and the only Westminster win from this set of elections. So I think they'll probably be very proud of that vote. And with an election, just a few months away, I guess they'd want to draw as much attention to that vote as possible.
And how are the Conservatives going to try and spin this? Could it get really bad for the Prime Minister?
It's kind of hard to tell just yet because, you know, and this is always the case with some of these local elections with mayorals, because the results are eking out over the course of a few days. So it's a little bit difficult to judge just now. I think one of the things that perhaps should have mentioned earlier is just how well the Reform Party is doing.
Yeah.
You know, polling's one thing, but then votes at the ballot box, they did quite well in Blackpool, for example. They've done quite well in the Northeast. They've done quite well in most areas, actually. So that threat to the Conservative Party vote really is real for Rishi Sunak. So he'll have to have some kind of dramatic response. But we've seen David Cameron come out so far kind of... I mean, Rishi Sunak himself has admitted that the results are disappointing, and David Cameron has said that it kind of had a very 2015 feel to it. David Cameron's response, it was kind of like stick with the plan and kind of don't change course too much. But I think if he wants to fight off some of the threat that his party faces from Reform, I think, and at the same time kind of try to compete with Labour, the Prime Minister's going to have to pick a path and a change, of course, because he can't be seen not to respond.
And as you say, the results in Blackpool were quite striking on Reform. Tories didn't quite come in third place, but I think they just scraped second by 120 votes, something like that. So, yeah, really, really squeaky result for them.
Yes, it's kind of similar to 2019 for Labour in some ways, where it was kind of competing with the Brexit Party in very many areas. Now it's, you know, the kind of reformed Brexit Party in reform that's competing with the Conservative Party on the right. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
And then there was quite a late but very big comms push on the government's immigration plan. Was that for voters or was it for backbenchers?
It's not clear, is it? I mean, I think you probably wanted it to do both jobs, because I know there's been a lot of unhappiness in the Conservative Party campaign throughout the local elections, actually. I know they've kind of must have been feeling this rising tide coming against them, and that always goes up the chain. And he's been feeling a lot of pressure from those on the right of his party to kind of get some of those flights going. So it kind of, although it didn't quite fit the criteria of a deportation as such, it was slightly more complicated than that. But it was striking, yeah, that he wanted to get that out before the local elections. And I think over the summer, the Prime Minister will want to show again, as much as he can, that the Rwanda policy can be successful for the government.
Akash, the other big story this week is in Scotland, which I know that you've been following very closely. Hamza Youssef has resigned as SNP leader. What do we know at the moment about the race to succeed him? And could we see an earlier than expected election in Scotland?
Earlier expected election now seems pretty unlikely. I mean, as things stand, there's only one declared candidate for SNP leadership and therefore to become new First Minister. That's John Swinney. Formerly leader of the SNP about 20 years ago, didn't work out too well for him that time round, but he subsequently had a very long and successful, I think, career as finance secretary, deputy first minister, and in other portfolios. So he's emerged as the sort of unity, safe pair of hands candidate to take the SNP forward after what's obviously been a pretty bad year and a bit for them. The person who would have been his main challenger, Kate Forbes, confirmed yesterday that she wasn't going to put her name forward this time. She came close to winning it against Hamza Youssef a year ago. That was how long ago, of course, it was since the last SNP leadership contest. So, I mean, it all seems set up for John Swinney to be crowned SNP leader once the nomination deadline closes, I think, on Tuesday of next week. And then John Swinney will be put forward for the Scottish Parliament to vote on in terms of the nomination vote that is held for who should become the First Minister. And sounds like he's going to have the support of the Greens, who, of course, were thrown out of the cooperation agreement by Hamza Youssef. But I don't think are going to sort of try and prevent the formation of a new SNP minority administration. And then, well, we'll see. I think John Swinney's got a lot of experience of working in minority government and indeed cooperating in particular with the Scottish Greens. So I expect he'll be well able and he'll already probably be talking to them about what they might want as a price for their ongoing support. So early election seems pretty unlikely. The next one there in Scotland is due in May 2026. I expect that's when it will be.
And then linking this back to the national picture, is this SNP meltdown? I mean, it has to be a bit of a dream come true to Keir Starmer, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of quite, you know, juicy marginal seats in north of the border in Scotland from a Labour perspective. They only won one seat in 2019 in Scotland, picked up one since in a by-election. But yeah, there's quite a lot of seats that sort of 10-15% swing there bring into play. So the more bad news there is for the SNP, the divisions the party have had, obviously the pretty damaging stories in the press about both Alex Salmond and then Nicola Sturgeon, and now the untimely fall of Hamza Youssef. None of those things really project the image of the SNP as a stable part and reliable party of government that they tried to build up over many years. So, yes, I mean, Labour will be looking to pick up possibly 20 plus seats, maybe even more in the coming general election. And then they'll also, of course, have their eyes on the next Scottish Parliament election as well. But as I say, who knows? I mean, with John Swinney in likely to be taking over next week, he may well steady the ship and things may start to move back in the other direction.
What do you make of the Scotland picture, Rachel?
I'm not sure I entirely agree that an early Scottish election is completely off the cards, actually. You know, I don't know, it just doesn't feel terribly stable for the SNP. And if I wonder if the relationship that they had with the Greens may not be so easily repaired, to be honest. But yeah, I think Labour will be, Anna Sawa will be licking his lips at the ongoing chaos, and just probably won't want to interrupt them while they're making these mistakes. But I was wondering about why Kate Forbes chose not to stand, really, because she really was something different, and I do wonder if that was her moment to go for it, really. But I think it probably is indicative of the fact that the SNP want to remain competitive in the central belt. You know, a lot of that central belt is very socially liberal and, you know, might not take to Kate Forbes in the same way they would have with you know, Humza Yousaf, for example. So, I think I'm not saying that I would predict a Scottish election this year, but I don't know if it'll go all the way to full term. Because a lot of their coalition partners, if they do go back into coalition, they'll certainly be wanting to set their own case out and wouldn't necessarily want to be tied to the SNP either.
The thing is, though, I mean, yeah, who knows? Yeah, the relationships could get strained again between SNP and the Greens. But it's actually quite hard to bring about an early election in Scotland. I mean, you need either a two-thirds majority vote specifically for dissolution or a 28-day period with no first minister and a failure to select a new one. So it's possible that could happen if all the opposition parties conspire to bring down the government at some point and then refuse to back anyone else to become first minister. But even if that were to happen, I mean, the other interesting thing about the law in that respect is there would still be an election in May 2026. Mm-hmm. It doesn't restart the clock on the five-year term. So even if we had a 2025 election in Scotland, there'd be a 2026 one as well, which might then strike people as a bit odd and maybe wouldn't go down so well with voters.
And then let's just take it back to Westminster too. So Rachel, we've had the spring budget, we've now had the local elections. It feels like the game-changing moments are starting to run out for either Labour or the government to make any massive changes or impact on voting intentions. But what should we be looking out for in the months ahead?
Well, I think Andrea Leadsom was on, the health minister was on media this afternoon saying that it was likely they were going to go to autumn for the general election. So that leaves all of the summer open for potential interventions. It also potentially would leave the party conference season open for one final chance to kind of really set out the party's case, I guess, before going to the polls. So that would be one intervention. I think immigration, is likely to continue to be an issue over the summer. And it's certainly the argument that Conservatives would like to have. I don't know, it really is very close now, so I'm not sure quite, other than within the short campaign itself and the manifestos, I'm not really sure what could be changed from between here and in the general election, really.
Yeah. Let's look, rather than what's coming up in the next few months, at a big challenge for whoever wins the next election, and that's how to fund pretty much everything. So for that, government departments need a spending review. They need one quickly. And Ben Paxton, IFG researcher and author of our new paper on this, is here to explain why it matters. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Emma.
So start with some of the basics. What is a spending review and when was the last one held?
So spending reviews in the UK are the process used by government to set spending plans for departments, often for multiple years at a time, but sometimes just for 1 year at a time. They're also an opportunity for governments to ask, are we getting good value for money out of our spending? And is the spending we're doing aligned with our priorities as a government? The last time this was done was in 2021. And that set spending plans for 3 years up to March 2025. And that means that the spending plans that are currently in place run out just under a year from now.
So they're running out quite soon. What does that mean in practice?
So that means that from March next year, departments don't know how much money they're going to have to spend. That's a lot of uncertainty for departments to deal with. So, you know, to take an example, the Ministry of Justice is facing some really serious challenges in prisons and the courts. And these are challenges that really require long-term thinking and long-term plans to be in place. But they don't know how much money they're going to have to spend on those challenges beyond March next year. And so they're facing a difficult situation, and the closer it gets to that point, the more difficult it's going to get for them and the more uncertainty there'll be. And it's notable that no government has ever left it later than November to set spending plans for the next financial year. And that's for good reason, because departments need at least a few months to get their spending plans and work out how they're going to spend that money in the next financial year. The later and later it gets in the year without spending plans, there's real uncertainty, and the worse that uncertainty is going to get. And so December is a real cliff edge for departments for getting those spending plans.
So more uncertainty. Give us a bit of historical context here, Ben. How close is the gap between a general election and budgets expiring this time compared to the previous elections?
So the last time we had a spending review in the same year as a general election was in 2019. And Boris Johnson had just become Prime Minister, and he ran a spending review before that December 2019 general election. The last times before that were in 2010 and 2015, and the general elections came around now, so with the local elections in May. And that meant there was over 6 months for the government between the election to the December cliff edge for them to set budgets. Now, the Chancellor now has said that there's not going to be a spending review until after the election. And the problem is we don't know when that election obviously is going to be. It could be any time from June through to January. But whenever it does come, it's going to be closer to that point at which budgets expire than any point in the last 40 years at least. And if we did get a late autumn election or a winter election, that would be coming right in November, December, even January. And that would be closer to that kind of December cliff edge when the uncertainty and instability becomes a real problem than any election before.
And so if we, because as you say, I mean, the latest a general election can take place is actually the end of January, is the 28th of January 2025. So if December is the cliff edge, what happens if we fall over it?
So if there were to be an election in December, yeah, even January, the government would be really forced to set spending plans in just a few short weeks, which would be unprecedented. There's never been in that situation where the government's had to do that so quickly in order to give departments certainty from the next financial year. It's never been done before, but we think that it should be done as quickly as possible in that scenario. Oh, I hope it's not quite that late.
Me too. Rachel, Rishi Sunak has said that he won't hold a spending review until after the election. Is he trying to make things difficult for Labour?
Yes. You know, I think every other kind of story you see in the press at the moment is this a trap for Labour? And I think one of the biggest hurdles the Conservative Party would have to clear to be competitive in the next election is to kind of discredit Rachel Reeves in some way, or kind of say that she's looser on her plans for the economy and on her fiscal rules than she's currently saying. So I think they probably want to pile as much pressure on in that area as possible. I think the position of the Labour Party in response would probably be, you know, well, here's an example of a big risk that the Conservative Party is taking as a result, and you have to wonder how that might reflect on them after the election if they really do fail to set out some new plans.
And so should Starmer and Rees be setting out right now what they will do in the first spending review if they win the election?
I think they'll probably stay away from that as much as possible. I think they'll certainly be under pressure too. You know, when you look at some of the places that you've seen some pushback on the left flank of their vote today. Some of those areas have been really hit quite hard by austerity since 2010. So some places will really want to see some movement. So I think there's might be some kind of electoral imperative for them to kind of start to talk about it a little bit more. But every sign that you get from the Labour Party is that that's unlikely to happen, really. Yeah.
And then, Akash, we've talked a bit about how difficult late plans are for departments, but this situation must be an enormous headache for local and devolved governments too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the reality is we have a quite centralised fiscal system still in this country, which means that budgets of devolved governments all across the country, so including in terms of the national devolved governments in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, are heavily dependent on decisions taken at Westminster. We have the Barnett formula, which determines changes to the devolved block grants. If in Edinburgh or Cardiff or Belfast there is uncertainty or complete lack of information about what the UK government's spending plans are likely to be next year, or ideally a few years ahead, it's of course very difficult for devolved ministers and officials to make plans over that period as well. So they do often just have to wait and adapt quite quickly to decisions taken at Westminster. And then, and of course, similar applies in terms of local government, which in England, which as we all know, is under huge strain, lots of councils facing enormous fiscal problems, crises, in fact, lots of them in effective bankruptcy or close to it. And as we all know with these things, making effective plans requires information about the fiscal forecasts with a good lead time, so people can plan where cuts are going to fall and how they're going to manage and live within their means. It's very difficult when there's such uncertainty about these things at Westminster.
And local government suffers particularly from that uncertainty, and is also one of the reasons that December is a real cliff edge. Local government normally gets their kind of draft spending plans in December, and again, they've never got those later than December, or at least not for 25 years. And so if there were to be an election late in November, December, say, the next government, whatever colour, whoever they are, would have a really short time frame to provide that certainty by the end of December in the way that every government has done before. Can't see a specific kind of legal reason they couldn't go beyond December, but the uncertainty, one person who works in senior local government told us that would be extremely challenging for them.
And so, this situation's causing enormous uncertainty, instability, inability for central, regional or local government to properly plan ahead. If that's the kind of the problem, Ben, what's the solution that that we at IFG are setting out in the paper that we've just published?
So we've said that spending reviews are really important for setting priorities and aligning spending with them. But the reality is, to do that well takes time. And we think it probably takes at least several months, possibly kind of up to a year to do. And the reality is, in 2024, whenever the election does come, the next government, whoever they are, just won't have time to do that kind of comprehensive multi-year spending review. So we recommend that the next government does a one-year spending round where they would set budgets for just the next financial year to provide that certainty for departments, local authorities, devolved governments, and avoid that instability and uncertainty that would come from leaving it any later. And, that should be done quickly, possibly in a few weeks, maybe a few months if we had a slightly earlier election, but it should be concluded by that December cliff edge wherever possible. Once they've done that, they then have time to run a comprehensive multi-year spending review that really could review existing policy in depth and make sure that the spending plans they have are really aligned with their priorities and what they want to deliver as a government for the rest of the parliament.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of Inside Briefing. Many thanks to Akash Palm, to Ben Paxton, and especially to Rachel Wearmouth. Thanks so much for being with us. Remember, you can find Inside Briefing on Acast, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. So please do subscribe and get into the voting spirit by leaving us a good review. You can find Akash and his team's local election analysis on our website. And Ben's fantastic new paper on spending reviews is there too. The story of these elections isn't quite complete yet, but a picture is starting to form. Now, these votes weren't just or even mainly about Westminster, but things could get very lively when Parliament returns next week. Thanks.